Throughout World War II, Hitler promised that Nazi propaganda dubbed Wunderwaffe, wonder weapons, would win the war for the German people. Well, most of these weapons remained prototypes or reached combat too late in the war and in too insignificant numbers. It did get a close run with the V-1 and V-2 rockets, the jet aircraft the Germans were working on, and of course, atomic weapons research. However, in the early years of the war, one area of radical German advance could easily have turned the tide of the war. I'm talking about magnetic and acoustic mine technology. Up until then, mines were just balls with those long prongs on them, and if the prong hit the side of a ship, it went off. Well, the Allies initially had few or no answers to these new forms of mines, and the destruction to shipping was enormous. There was a real fear that Britain would not be able to continue the fight. But the efforts of a small band of mine diffusers allowed the Allies to overcome that threat, and that group included four Australian naval officers who volunteered to defuse the deadly parachute mines, volunteered. The Germans were dropping them over Britain and European ports throughout World War II. They all received the George Cross for their courage, but their work was secret. In fact, only recently have the files and memoirs been accessible, and their story is now told through a new book, appropriately titled One False Move. The historian and author Robert Macklin with us now. Robert, welcome back to Breakfast.
Thank you very much, James.
Look, firstly, why were mines and the efforts to defuse them so critically important during World War II?
Well, as you mentioned, the Germans were determined to cut Britain off, and from the food and the other munitions and the other materials that they desperately needed. And these mines formed a kind of a garrote around the English throat, and they just squeezed it tighter and tighter. And at the early part of the war, there was just no knowledge in the British Admiralty as to how they could possibly deal with these things. And it took the lives of many men before they really understood how to defuse the mines. And then it was about that time that these four very remarkable Australians began their work in a very small team called the RMS team, the Rendering Mine Safe team, that started the fight back. And of course, the Germans realized quite soon that they were able to defuse particular kinds of mechanisms, and so they kept changing the mechanisms, and they kept changing booby traps, which they put into the mines to either blow the arms off these men or absolutely destroy them when the mine itself went off.
So these four Australian men, what, among only 15 altogether in the early part of the war, defusing mines? Their story largely unheralded. Why is that?
Well, the reason, James, is that the work that they were doing was secret. And even after the war, it was top secret, because the technology was actually transferred to the United States, because the Americans actually captured the man in Germany, the German Nazi, who was responsible for most of these mines, a man called Herbert Ruhlmann, who was still very favourably remembered and commemorated in parts of Germany today.
What did the Americans do with him?
They put him to work in Maryland with other Nazis they'd captured, doing exactly the same thing for them as he had done for the Nazis in their Cold War against the Soviets.
Tell me about the four Australian men.
Well, the four Australian men were absolutely remarkable fellows. There was Stuart Mould from Sydney, Hugh Syme. Stuart was an architect. Hugh Syme, he was a member of the famous newspaper family, owners of The Age. George Goss in South Australia, he was also a member of a famous family. In fact, his cousin is Alexander Downer. And then in Perth, there was Leon Goldsworthy, who turned out to be the most decorated Australian naval officer in our history. He actually did most of his defusing of the mines underwater at depth, and he defused in total some 300 or more mines, both in Europe, in Britain, and then he joined the Americans and worked with them against the Japanese in the tunnels beneath Corregidor.
And all four men survived the war.
Yes, they did, James. They survived, but by God, it took a terrible toll upon them.
Psychologically?
It did, yes, physically and nervously.
Many other defusers were killed?
Oh, so many. At least 75 of their colleagues were killed. These fellas, they were very special guys. Before the war, Syme and Mould were really playboys, and so indeed was George Goss. But something happened to them when they got to Britain, and they really began to understand that we were fighting for civilization itself. And it just seemed to change their attitudes and their personalities, and they became very, very dedicated. Leon Goldsworthy, I think, began as a very dedicated little bloke. He was a tiny little fella. In fact, he had these two hammer toes, you know, where your little toe goes over the second toe. And that was preventing him from being able to get into the Navy in the first place. So he went into hospital and had his two little toes amputated he could get into the war.
There is an argument that is made that the work of these defusers, especially given the error of Goering and the Luftwaffe, was critical in the outcome of the war. We'll get to that error in a minute. But the remarkable that the outcome in this sense could hinge on the inward-turned little toe of an Australian sailor.
That's so true.
It's 20 past 8 on RN Breakfast. We're speaking with Robert Macklin. His moving book and testimony is One False Move. Did this operate in reverse as well? Were there British mines defused by German defusers?
The British began the war pretty much unprepared, and their knowledge the kinds of newfangled mines was very, very basic. It was only a man called John Ouvrey who had actually been in Australia earlier and got married in Australia. He was a British naval officer. Who was doing some pioneering work in Britain, and so they made him the head of this little group of RMS lads, the Render Mine Safe Team. So yes, there was a lot of work being done on the British side as well, but that's a different story. It's not the story that I followed through.
And you mentioned at the early days of the war, English knowledge of mines was very crude because they'd only dealt with crude mines themselves.
Yes, those horned mines that you spoke of.
Yes, and then the Germans increased the sophistication, but Hermann Göring decided to acquire control of the mining program on behalf of the Luftwaffe. So instead of the Navy placing the mines, what the Air Force did it by dropping them from parachutes. Why did he make that decision, and what was its significance?
He made the decision, I believe, because he was an arrogant pig. He knew that this was Hitler's baby. Hitler really believed that these mines were going to cause Britain to surrender, and he wanted to be the deliverer of these the secret weapons. And while they were being delivered by the Navy from the U-boats and destroyers, there was no way that the British could get hold of them to understand what was inside them.
The first contact you have is when you die.
That's right. That's right. But once they were put into aeroplanes and given parachutes, some of them landed on the seashores and in the cities, and this allowed, and they didn't explode.
Like mud flats or soft landing in trees, this kind of thing.
Exactly, exactly. And this is what allowed our lads to actually get hold of them and at some cost, of course, many died, but they were finally able to discover the workings inside. And the first ones, of course, were the magnetic mines, which exploded when a ship passed over the top of them.
And this race began first with the magnetic and then greater and greater sophistication developed by the Germans on the one side, across the channel, diffused by the English ever learning on their way at the price of death on the other. How did this progression evolve?
Well, first of all, it was, as I say, the magnetic mines. And once they solved that problem, the Germans turned to acoustic mines. So these were exploded by sound, the sound of the ship's engine, but the ship's propeller, but also other extraneous sounds. I mean, there was one occasion when Stuart Mould was lying on a beach with some binoculars looking at a mine that he was going to approach, and he actually saw a crab crawl up on the mine, and it was just the sound of the crabs crawling that blew the mine up. So it was enormously delicate work that these men had to do. And then, of course, it went, once they solved the acoustic side of things, the Germans combined magnetic and acoustic, and then they moved on to photoelectric, so that if they pulled the dome off the top of the mine, the light itself hitting these photoelectric cells would explode it and destroy the surroundings. It would destroy a whole city block, as well as breaking the back of a capital ship if it was exploded underneath it.
Which is why your remarkable sailors learnt to diffuse in the dark, just one of so many amazing stories in Robert Macklin's book. Thank you, Robert, for being with us.
Thank you, James.
Robert Macklin, the historian biographer, the book One False Move, aptly titled The Bravest of the Brave, Australian Mine Diffusers in World War II. It's published by Hachette on RN Breakfast, 8:26.